Thank God for Julie Frost, huh? Okay, thank you. Hello, Judge.
Hey, Doc, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Not bad for a Tuesday.
Okay, do you have slides at all? Do you have a PowerPoint or no?
I don't.
Okay, that's
just
fine.
Just got me.
Okay, that's good. So we know. It's about a little bit before five. Most of them show up right at five, and then there's usually stragglers. We usually end up with usually anywhere from 20 to 40. Is our usual crowd.
Okay.
So I appreciate your taking the time, and I anticipate we're going to have quite a few questions. I got a couple of announcements I make right before we start, and then we'll just let you do your thing. So So your trial was postponed, was that it?
Yeah, the state had a necessary witness who's avoiding service of process, so I had to issue what's called a material witness warrant.
Are you allowed to do that?
He's available, you can't really go forward.
Are you allowed to do that?
Yeah.
No, I don't mean that. I meant you. I meant you'll have to avoid the services.
No, you're not supposed to do that. It generally ends up with a one-way ticket to jail.
I was going to say.
Yeah. I don't recommend it.
Yeah. So, yeah, but no, it doesn't sound – it's not something that's ever been in my world. But
Yeah, I recommend you keep it that way.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I try to stay away from lawyers. And
well, lawyers aren't all bad, but the criminal justice system.
Yeah, we try to stay out of that. So,
yeah.
So, okay. So we have the only one on so far is Dr. Ortel. She's one of our regulars. So, and she's a good a big contributor. So, just relax for a few minutes, and we'll start popping on. Okay.
Okay.
And like I said, I have a couple of announcements to make, and then we'll do our thing. Okay.
All right. I'll see you in a few.
Okay, so. Danny B.
Yo, Big Bill, what's happening?
Oh, you know, causing trouble.
Let's have a talk soon on OMED and what we can do in Boston.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Hey, do you have friends there at Harvard?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anybody at Harvard that's doing anything fun, special?
I have some friends in Boston. I'm not sure. You know, we're all moving on here. I don't know if they're still working or not. You know, I'm out here in the middle of nowhere.
Well,
I'll ask around.
Okay. I'd like to take advantage of it. 1984, the year I graduated from medical school. That's like 38 years ago. they had a Harvard research team said that osteopathic training was superior to Harvard training. So they hired two osteopaths and tried to upgrade holistic broad spectrum integrative medicine. But I don't know where they've gone with it, so I need to check that out. I just reviewed their main connections in integrative medicine, and we seem to be light years ahead of them.
Wow. I always quote Dr. T. Porton, who was the head of our osteopathy department at our school in 1975, July 1st. He got up on the stage and said, "We're not Harvard, we're better."
That's good. Mm-hmm. Well, so in the next few weeks, I want to see if we can get some connections there.
Okay.
Hey, guys.
Hi, Kent.
Hey, hi, Kent.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good.
How are you guys doing?
Everything's good. Hello, Cheryl. Hello, Marie. Ta-da. We're happening.
Hello, everyone.
We're all good. Dr. Savani is one of our connections from the convention, and Judge Walker's on the line. He's waiting for us to give him the okay here. So for that, though, I do want to share with you this letter that I got from the AOA, sent to me. So you know that it's official. We scored 99.5 out of 100, and the 0.5 was those of you that were with us in Reno 2 years ago. Dr. Manfredoni apparently didn't sign the right form. He was we did that pain management class. The AOA brought him in. They didn't sign the right form for him, so we lost a half a point. Otherwise, we had 100. So we have been awarded a 5-year accreditation, which is as good as any other subspecialty can get. That's the top accreditation.
Congratulations.
So we're in like Flint. So those of you that were at our conference, the DOs, you should already have your credits been credited. Those of you that are not, I have a little bit of paperwork yet. I still haven't gotten the final bill from the hotel. That, you know, they were such stellar folks. So I'm supposed to come out the end of this week. So hopefully you'll be getting your credits shortly. So the DOs or the MDs and anybody who gets the MD credits, the AMA credits. So they'll be coming shortly. Okay. So Dr. Zarin will be on a little bit later. Also, we're going to talk a little bit about, we're going to do something a little bit more formal the last Tuesday of every month. I don't know if we can get it together for next week, but we'll try. We're looking to have it a little bit of a payment for that also. So I don't know how much of an objection there'll be to that, but so she'll be on in a little while, but we'll probably after Judge Walker's finished to talk about that. So with that, let me stop this share. And over here is Judge Egan Walker. Over here now. He moved. And Judge Walker's, not to divulge too many secrets, but he's been my patient for quite a while. He's quite prominent in town, I thought it might be, you know, we've had some discussions over the last couple of weeks, and even Dr. Halas's group also, about some legal issues. So I thought it might be good if we get this perspective straight from somebody who actually knows what he's talking about. You know, as doctors, we talk about it all the time, but we really don't. Except for Dr. Burgess's, so Sylvia here, Dr. Burgess is this Dr. Cruz here. She's actually a lawyer also. So other than her, The legal, you know, this is sort of one of those murky areas that we try to stay away from. So I'm going to let you introduce yourself, and I'll let folks in as they go. Judge Walker doesn't have any slides, so he's going to do what he does. So this is Judge Egan Walker. So thank you for being with us.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for the privilege of joining you all, Dr. Clearfield. Folks, my name's Egan Walker. I happen to be a district court judge in Reno, Nevada. Reno is the city center, if you will, of Washoe County. It's a county of about 500,000 people. I'm one of 16 trial court judges in our county. And I happen to be a patient of Dr. Clearfield's. And when most recently I saw him, he mentioned your organization that you folks have sort of a weekly chat and thought I might have some useful information for all of you. I suppose we'll see if that's true at all. I welcome and suggest that your interruptions or questions to me. Your questions to me will provide the best use to all of you. And so please interrupt at any time. Throw a hand up. Let me know. Bill, throw me a lifeline if you think I'm wandering far afield from anything that will be relevant to all of you. But let me tell you a little bit about me because it will inform kind of two broad areas I wanted to share with you. First, some insights as a patient to an integrative medicine practice through Dr. Clearfield, and then some insights as a judge and a lawyer to the medical profession in general and sort of the world in which you all work. And we'll see if that is at all relevant to all of you. So first, I'll just share with you, I happen to be 60 years of age. My undergraduate degree is in nursing, so I actually have a Bachelor of Science in nursing. And the way I put myself through law school was as an ICU, CCU, OR nurse, and I've been a flight medic in the military before that. So just so you all know, that just means I have enough knowledge to be dangerous where medical terminology is concerned, and I'll welcome you to keep me on track if I go too far afield. I'm married. My wife and I are both patients of Dr. Clearfield's, and really that's where my story for all of you tonight begins. I'll kind of share with you what I hope is a patient's perspective, and a patient who comes kind of from the allopathic medical world, right? My undergraduate degree being in nursing. I shared with you I worked as an OR nurse and an ICU nurse years and years ago. That's how I put myself through law school. And so coming into an integrative medicine practice was a bit of an eye-opener to me. My wife and I were referred to Dr. Clearfield because we had been seeing a naturopathic doctor because my wife was struggling with some autoimmune issues and in particular some thyroid issues. Happens I also have some thyroid issues, and that's kind of how we came to Dr. Bill. So a story I'll share with all of you that really sets the table for the conversation for me is this. Much to his chagrin, I suspect, Dr. Clearfield knows that I've had both of my knees replaced in the last 18 months. So I've been a victim or a beneficiary, as the case may be, of sort of the allopathic medical world and the traditional treatment, if you will, for osteoarthritis in that vein. Well, the story I wanted to share with you, which is really my insight as a patient into your world, is this. I was going to see Dr. Clearfield after I'd had my second knee replaced. So I was about, 8 or 10 days out of surgery, limping around, hurting pretty bad. And one of my favorite stories about Dr. Clearfield was walking in and he said, "Boy, you look like you're hurting." He did whatever he was going to do. I'll share with you kind of his thyroid management, hormone supplementation for me. But he did something very interesting to me. He said, "Hey, would you mind if I did something that might make you feel better?" And then he started putting some acupuncture placements all around my ears. And understand, I'd never had acupuncture therapy as a patient in my life. I'd heard about it, read about it, seen him do it to my wife, but never had it. And he just kept chatting with me, kept sort of distracting me. And what do you know, if almost instantaneously, I had a significant increase in the range of motion of my knee and significant relief from pain. And one of my favorite stories about Dr. Clearfield, I'll tell all of you, is I asked him, "Well, why does that work? How does it work? And he says, well, I don't know. We don't know. We just know that it works. And I hope you all agree with me. It's a relevant story for the world in which you all work, because you really see that world is designed toward patient care and patient comfort and quality of life issues. And of course, Bill didn't charge me for it. I'm not sure even documented it in a formal chart, but it was kind of a heartwarming contact for me as somebody who's been around the medical profession, been a healthcare provider, at least as a nurse myself, and then, been exposed to broad ranges of medical treatment. The other story I'll share with you, which is very relevant to the world in which we live right now, is this. So in December of 2020, two Decembers ago, I contracted COVID here in our community. And I, being stubborn and being a nurse and not being the greatest of patients, I decided to delay intervention, which turned out to be a remarkable mistake. So much so that finally I started desaturating with oxygen, and I became really quite lethargic. So I ended up going to the hospital that is about a stone's throw from my house, and was admitted with severe COVID. In fact, when I saw my chest x-rays after I was discharged from the hospital, they were quite frankly a whiteout. Looking at my chest x-rays, I'm surprised I didn't end up intubated and ventilator dependent. I didn't. But one of the things I wanted to share with all of you, one of the reasons I don't think I ended up ventilator dependent, is because I had started low-dose naltrexone with Dr. Clearfield about 4 to 6 months before I contracted COVID. And, it's of course an off-label use of naltrexone. It's not a use of naltrexone as an anti-inflammatory that I've been aware of at all as a medical professional or as a patient. But I actually had my wife bring the naltrexone to me in the hospital and took it while I was in the hospital. And I was discharged after 5 days. Didn't have to be intubated, never was over about 4 liters of nasal oxygen. Did get IV remdesivir in the hospital. But to this day, it's completely anecdotal. I really think the powerful anti-inflammatory effect of the low-dose naltrexone was critical to getting out of the hospital. And so I come to you all kind of hopefully not boring you with my stories, but just sharing as a patient of integrative or so-called alternative medicine, some pretty profound successes for me as a patient, as the husband of a patient. My wife gets hormonal replacement therapy, gets testosterone supplementation through Dr. Clearfield. And it really is, I must say, in many ways, life-changing. And so at 60, when I came to see Bill, I want to say 3 years ago, maybe as many as 4 years ago, I was, borderline obese. I was closing in on metabolic syndrome, if not type 2 diabetes, had hypothyroid symptoms, and, was kind of living the middle American dream, or nightmare, as the case may be, of being on the margin. And just 2 months ago, I had a full set of labs done again, and no longer bordering on type 2, kind of normalized my thyroid levels, and really improved my overall health in ways that I would not have expected. And so, not to overshare, but to share some of the kind of on the edge or alternative treatments that I've been benefit to. I was receiving thyroid replacement through an internal medicine doc here in town, came to Dr. Clearfield, and he pointed out that perhaps I needed both T3 and T4, turned out to be right, offered some hormone supplementation, specifically testosterone, but also offered some health management insights. So, supplements that are short of medication interventions, berberine, curcumin, ADK, glutamine, just a whole variety of things that really were supportive in a much more holistic way of my overall health. And then the low-dose naltrexone as well. And so when Bill asked me to talk, he suggested that perhaps it would be useful to all of you to share my perspectives as a patient. And so there you have it. I really have come around to believe that a much more holistic view of my individual health, but the health of a cross-section of a community is really much more what I've needed as a patient, as a professional in my community, et cetera. So, Bill, I'm going to pause there and ask if there are any questions you have or anything you would suggest that you think your colleagues might need to know, or any questions you all have for me as a patient.
Well, so far I've got $10 coming to you for that, for all those attaboys there. So it's about what it's worth. So I'm going to leave it open to the group to see if they have any questions. Part of what we want to do is if you could, you know, share some of what, you know, what are some of the landmines that we can avoid, legally. That's, you know, part of, you know, why I'd like to have you here. As far as, if it's okay to talk about you, that's fine. You know, everything's, confidential. So I don't say anything.
You are free to talk about my treatment. I will get to the legal landmines, I promise, Bill.
Right.
But I think you wanted me to share sort of a patient's perspective as well.
Yeah. So this gets about 4 years ago. Yeah. So Judge Walker had high antithyroid antibodies. His thyroid was not really well controlled. Like he said, he was borderline, obese. I think his BMI was around 27. So we needed an overall tune-up. So that's kind of what we did. And it didn't take that long, right? I mean, maybe 6 months before we sort of turned the corner.
That was pretty remarkable. I have to say, adding both T3 and T4 from a patient's perspective, it's all anecdotal, but I felt almost an immediate difference. And of course, the interesting thing to me about that, Dr. Clearfield, is the internal med guy I was going to would say, well, none of that is supported in the literature, right? That's not.
It depends on what literature you. It depends on what literature you read.
Right.
So for those of us out here, I don't know if you can see this. I got this. I think it came yesterday, the Journal of Family Practice, and the big lead article is on how to treat hypothyroidism. And the bottom line is, you don't do anything unless the TSH is greater than 10. You only give Synthroid. And, make sure you have a healthy diet. Basically that summarizes this. And as we know, and, I can't really speak for anybody else, but there isn't anything that I haven't done, for you or anybody else that I don't have literature for. We do have the literature for it. The powers that be might not like all of the literature. There's always a problem with our literature, not as opposed to their literature. The things that we do are not really out of the realm of, hocus pocus I don't make it up. I mean, I can show you chapter and verse of everything that we do, and why we do it. Sometimes you have to look a little bit harder than a textbook that was written in 1975. But there it is. So, I mean, Dr. Patel over here next to you in here is, has been doing incredible integrative oncology work, using all sorts of, therapies, light therapies and methylene blue and, all sorts of, and it's not that there isn't literature on it. It's just that, you need to go find it.
Bill, what's fascinating as a patient is when I came to see you and when Shelley, my wife, came to see you, both of us had normal thyroid levels, right? Or within the normal range. They weren't optimal, however. They weren't optimal for either one of us. And it wasn't until there was kind of a more holistic look about, well, okay, that's great, but what will work for you, Egan, that I really felt improvement.
Right. So, and again, and I don't think anybody, you know, that's on here, you know, would disagree. You know, we have a couple of new folks, names I see. But I don't think anybody who's been doing this work for a while would disagree that, you know, normal just isn't good enough. Normal is, if you don't know what it is, it's two standard deviations of whatever you're measuring, which is 95.4% of, you know, whatever the measurement is. So for example, if you take 25 vitamin D, most of the labs will tell you 30 to 100 is normal. Well, 32 is normal and 98 is normal. Well, that's ridiculous. That's just ridiculous. Right? 29 is abnormal. 31 is normal. I mean, that's, you know, that just doesn't work. So, you know, we teach our students, how to optimize that. And so I won't go into the details, but, you know, so our goal is usually about 50 to 80, but there's a formula, and I tell every patient if they're interested, I work it out for them, you know, and say, this is how we do it. And I tell them, you know, where I'm at, I'm at 4th and McCarran. I tell them we stop 1,000 cars on right on my street corner here, and we should get 954 of them should have a vitamin D between 30 and 100. But, you know, that's just not going to be good enough. So, you know, a TSH of greater than 10, if you don't do anything before, you know, less than that, that's what it says in here. This just came out yesterday, is, you know, ridiculous. And, you know, and you can go on to them, you know, nowadays you can go on to all sorts of forums and say, your doctor says that they're not going to do anything unless they're only going to look at the TSH. And if it's greater, less than 10, they're not going to do anything. Go find somebody else. So, I can't speak for anybody else, but I know Dr. Kelly, I see Zon. I know Dr. Kelly, you know, has been doing this for a long time. And, Dr. Burgess. I know that, you know, I'm fairly certain that they'll agree with me that, you know, we try to find the, you know, scientific evidence, to back up, you know, what we do. Okay. So it's not, you know, it's not anecdotal and it's not sort of wishful thinking. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we had Dr. Jacob Teitelbaum, and I don't know if you know him. He's actually very famous in the fibromyalgia world. He wrote one of the original textbooks in 1975, and he threw out a statement about saying, well, the patients have some thyroid symptoms and, but their lab numbers are normal, or I can't even get a lab normal. I'll just give them thyroid medication anyway. And that caused a little bit of a kerfuffle. And I don't do that, but, you know, so, so some of our students were a little bit upset about that. You know, he's one of the gurus or one of the masters. So I said, well, you got to take what the master, learn from the master and make it your own. So, that's kind of what we do there. So, so there's so 2 weeks ago I was at the Age Management Medical Group. And there was some of the big issues were, the FDA is trying to shut down, compounded bioidentical hormones, which I think would be a tragedy. You know, they're all hell bent on it. And they get, again, some of the traditional medical groups to say, well, this stuff is no good. And they'll give you 900 reasons why what we do is no good, but the stuff that comes out of Pfizer or whatnot is good. You know, those guys are not, you know, no saints either. You know, we'll, you know, if we have something that doesn't work, we're going to adjust our methods. But, I don't know if you've come across any of this on the legal side. And if you have, you know, we're all sort of swimming here, you know, with without a paddle. So, I know Dr. Halassa's group, which is a group that we're sort of affiliated with on Monday night, they're looking to, and I think Dr. Cruz is going to be involved, have a physician advocacy group for, you know, with some legal, you know, at least advice.
Well, yeah, diving into the legal issues then, let me begin in this way, Bill. First, I work as a state trial court judge, so the jurisdiction that I am privileged to practice in is unlimited. What that means is if the matter in controversy exceeds $15,000, it comes to a trial court judge in Nevada like me. And I've done about 8 medical malpractice trials as a judge in the 12 odd years I've been a state trial court judge. I was in the family division and I'm now in the general jurisdiction. And I have some broad areas of commentary for all of you. And then I'll try to drive, Bill, to your point about what I think is your point about how do you, in this practice area, deal with other practice areas and the pressures you get financially, et cetera. I don't see a lot of that, but I'll share some insights, for example, into some of the large physician group litigation, the hospital litigation against large physician groups that I see, et cetera. But backing way up, let's talk about the framework of medical malpractice in Nevada. It'll be different in every jurisdiction in the United States, but very similar from 100,000 feet. And so seen from 100,000 feet, most jurisdictions in the United States have enacted so-called tort reform legislation or rules related to torts, medical malpractice being a form of tort in most jurisdictions that are very favorable to medical practitioners. So, for example, in Nevada, the statute of limitations, the period of time after something goes wrong in which you can file a lawsuit is generally 1 year, which is a very short period of limitations. It's very difficult for patients, if they have been wronged in some way, to actually get together their medical records, find an attorney, find an expert, and file a lawsuit within a year's period of time. And that shortened period of limitations exists in most jurisdictions in the United States, as I understand it. And I offer that as a reassurance to all of you that actually it's intended, in Nevada it's specifically intended, as a protection to professionals, not just physicians, not just osteopathic doctors and others, but specifically to folks who work in the medical field. That shortened period of limitations is a protection because the window of time in which a lawsuit can be filed is fairly short. In Nevada, there are procedural protections. So in Nevada, if a patient seeks to sue a physician or a doctor, that the lawsuit has to be accompanied by an expert affidavit. So another physician in the same specialty area as the questioned physician has to opine that the questioned physician deviated from the standard of care and that deviation was the cause of injury to the patient. And that affidavit has to accompany the lawsuit. So unlike some other jurisdictions where you can be sued for simply the cost of a lawsuit, the cost of the filing fee, as it were, in Nevada, you have to specifically have this expert affidavit. And if you don't have it, if it's not filed at the outset of the lawsuit, the lawsuit is mandatorily dismissed. It must be dismissed. And so the procedural protections come at the very beginning of the case. Additional protections in Nevada are that the damages that can be sought, meaning the money that can be sought from a professional, are limited. So in Nevada, so-called non-economic damages for a medical malpractice cause of action are limited to $350,000. So that means damages for pain and suffering, damages for loss of consortium, damages for the loss of enjoyment of life, the kind of nebulous damages that in decades past and years past had resulted in monstrous verdicts in medical malpractice cases have been limited in Nevada and are in most jurisdictions. The number of attorneys in Nevada willing to take on claims against a medical professional are relatively small because the costs of bringing a medical malpractice lawsuit are very high. The average cost to a plaintiff to bring a medical malpractice claim. So for example, using a terrible example, but if the wrong body part is operated on, if a right knee was called on for intervention and a left knee was operated on, for example, which is in our jurisdiction malpractice per se, even in that sort of a circumstance, the number of attorneys willing to take the case is relatively small because the costs to get that kind of a case trial ready are in the neighborhood of $250,000 to $500,000 between expert witnesses, cost of preparation, et cetera. And so the table I want to lay for all of you in my comments about the world of medical malpractice from a trial judge's perspective is that the world of medical malpractice is fairly hostile, at least in Nevada and California, two jurisdictions with which I'm relatively familiar. It's fairly hostile to plaintiffs who want to bring claims. That's intentional in Nevada, and there was tort reform. Was there a question? There was a court reform legislative crisis in Nevada in 2002. That legislative crisis led to a lot of the procedural protections that I just illustrated or outlined for all of you, to include the economic damages or the non-economic damages cap, that I just described. An interesting kind of color item I would share with all of you about malpractice claims, at least as I see them as a trial judge in Nevada and to a lesser degree in California, is that patients, that's the world from which a juror would be chosen, patients like all of you. Patients tend to identify with their treating providers. Patients tend to see the best in their treating providers. And so juries, interestingly enough, are very conservative in medical malpractice cases about when they identify, that is, find as a matter of fact that an act of malpractice has occurred. And they're very conservative in terms of the dollar amounts they're willing to put on awards. So as an example, a dental malpractice trial, a case that actually went to trial in my jurisdiction, resulted in a jury verdict of about $175,000. Now, you might ask how was dental malpractice valued at that amount, but it was, in fact, a fairly egregious case of malpractice that I'll use as an illustration or a story in terms of my advice for all of you to avoid a claim of malpractice. I've seen, I have active right now, I can't speak specifically about the facts, but I have two malpractice actions that both involve catastrophic neurological injuries related to stroke, either stroke misdiagnosis or a failure to intervene with TPA in an acute care, acutely evolving stroke incident. Those cases will likely resolve before trial. And that's sort of the final procedural observation I would offer to you, that most medical malpractice claims don't end up going to trial. If in fact there has been an error made, if in fact there is direct evidence of so-called malpractice, for the most part, those cases settle. So I see very few cases actually go to trial as a percentage of the overall cases brought. And so what are my comments to all of you as practitioners? What's the best advice I would give for all of you in terms of the cases I've seen? So in the dental malpractice case that was tried to verdict, that I tried to verdict that I described to you, I believe the chief reason that poor dentist ended up being sued is because she chose to be dishonest with her patient. What I mean by that is she had engaged in a tooth removal, for lack of a better term, of an impacted molar, had inadvertently clipped the lingual nerve of the patient and had not been honest with the patient either about the signs and symptoms of the sequelae of impacting the lingual nerve or in her charting about what had occurred or had not occurred either during the operative event or in the follow-up in the few days after the operative event. The patient had come in. He was complaining of a persistent numbness on one side of his mouth, persistent numbness on one side of his tongue. And the practitioner had not accurately charted either an actual evaluation of the patient or any findings related to an evaluation of the patient. And so in the cold, hard light of day, by the time it got to trial several years later, the poor practitioner on the stand was in a very difficult position to try to explain how her claims about carefully evaluating the patient, carefully understanding the patient's persistent neuropathy and numbness, and the symptoms he had described, which clearly illustrated that his lingual nerve had in fact been severed, all of that came tumbling down on her late in the game. And so, quite honestly, my perspective as a lay witness, the judge in the case, again, with enough medical knowledge to be dangerous, was that had she simply been honest at the time of the event about what might have occurred, what might be going on with him, and about, you know, taking that extra moment to actually document what she claimed she had done, the outcome, I think, would have been much, much, much different. And that message of documentation and just being direct with patients, even when you make an error, is perhaps the best message I can give. Now, let me hasten to add, I'm sure if you talk to your legal counsel will tell you, well, the last thing you should do is admit making a mistake. And I'm not here to give legal advice to any of you. I can only tell you, as a former healthcare provider who made mistakes, fortunately not often, but I did make mistakes as a nurse, but who made mistakes, and now as a judge witnessing the lawsuits that result as a consequence of mistakes, overwhelmingly, unequivocally, the best practical advice I can give is be honest with your patients about what goes right and about what goes wrong. Because candidly, more often than not, the devil is in the lies told, whether they're lies by omission or lies by commission. The bad outcome comes because people get mad when they figure out after the fact that they either have been lied to, or that someone's been dishonest with them, or they think they've been lied to. And so, to sum it up from a judge's perspective, the overwhelmingly best advice I can give is just talk to your patients and be honest with them about the good, the bad, and the ugly of what does and doesn't happen, even if a mistake is made. Let me pause again and ask if there are any questions. That's really a multi-day, multi-hour lecture distilled into just a few minutes. So I want to give as much option as I can to all of you for questions or specific questions you may have.
Anybody have any questions, or put it in the chat otherwise?
I have a statement. Three words, well, however many words it is, standard of care. And I think that he and maybe some of you should elaborate on the problems that have come out of those words.
Sure. So standard of care is a community-specific term. And therein lies perhaps part of the challenge, right? So the standard of care in Reno, Nevada may be different than the standard of care in Ypsilanti, Michigan, or than the standard of care of Orlando, Florida. The standard of care in a medical malpractice case is established by your peers. So whoever the leading expert or the person who claims to be a leading expert, for example, in orthopedic care or in hormone replacement therapy or in choose the specific specialty that you're describing, it will be the leading proponent, the person published in the literature or the person willing to take a position who's published in the literature who describes what is the appropriate standard of care. So, Bill, it would be very interesting to see, for example, if you talk to the internal medicine docs, what they said the standard of care is for thyroid replacement. You know,
in your case, we're way off the chart.
Right. Right. And, you know, the internal medicine guys would say it is outside the standard of care to be treating my thyroid levels in the way they're being treated, even though that's my specific request. So standard of care is a slippery concept, and it's one that you need to be aware of as you engage in practice, in your own practice. You need to know what the standard of care is, for example, in this organization, if it promulgates or discusses standards of care, what the standard of care is in the allopathic medical world, and where the slings and arrows are going to come from. I don't know, Dr. Fogarty, if that answers your question. Did you have other questions, or would you like me to elaborate more?
Well, actually, that was the same thing that I had written down here about standard of care. And then I thought of, you know, you told us your story right at the beginning, and you know where you started, and then and you know how we sort of took things from there, and how much better you felt. But again, and it, in one of my lectures that I have, I had one of my nurses from a long time ago, and I got a letter from her doctor from back home. This was back home in Pennsylvania, who called me a quote unquote shaman and a disgrace to my degree. What are you supposed to say? I kind of took it as a badge of honor, but these are the pitfalls that we come across.
But Bill, if I may, the one thing that you do that I would suggest to your colleagues is a good idea is you and I have had frank discussions about, look, Egan, if you go to the allopathic medical community, talking specifically about thyroid treatment, you should know that what I'm suggesting to you is not what they will suggest. Because then, right, I make an informed decision about it, Bill.
Right.
I decide as a patient, okay, I understand he's described to me what the traditional standard of care is. I'm willing to accept something other than the traditional standard of care. And it's informed consent, right?
Right. So, and I know we're all supposed to have everything, you know, signed and sealed and delivered, but don't always do that. You know, you get busy, you kind of sometimes forget those kinds of things. And
yeah, of course, if it's not charted, it's not done. That's the bane of all of our right. existence.
Right. So, we had a lady, who we saw in March of 2021, and then she came in again in June. And I hadn't signed the chart. Sometimes, you know, I hadn't signed the chart in March. I noticed that, you know, when she came back the second time, so I signed it again. So now all of a sudden that was a fraud. Well, it was just an oversight, so I just signed it when I signed it. But, you know, that became a bone of contention because she said she was never here in March. Even though we had written her prescriptions and she was a new patient. I was, you know, I'm not in the habit of writing prescriptions for someone I don't know, just, you know, out of the blue, but you know, the chart was signed June 2nd instead of March 25th. So, you know, these things kind of happen, from time to time. So, anybody else have any, you know, experiences, any questions here? You know, this is kind of, you know, wide open forum. So,
I have a question just because we just mentioned it, and that's informed consent. In my understanding that informed consent only involves one aspect of the medical practice, and that is not for the patient to understand what is occurring physiologically or biochemically with them. The only required informed consent is for the patient to be clear on dose and dosage, how much to take and how often. The understanding is not even a requirement for informed consent.
You are correct about that, Dr. Burgess. When I was describing informed consent with Dr. Clearfield, I was using it as a term of description as much as a term of art. What I mean by that is, as a practitioner, you can protect yourself if, for example, I was ever to say, well, Clearfield gave me, you know, this armor thyroid that's I don't think that's controversial, but just let's say it was controversial. You know, Clearfield gave me this armor thyroid and I had some untoward sequelae. And
call one of the endocrinologists.
Yeah, I want to now bring a claim against him. If he can illustrate that he spoke with me about part of the rationale, whether I have a meaningful understanding or not about it or not, there is consent. Now, Dr. Burgess, what you're describing with informed consent is you have to confirm with me that it's okay for me to have you touch me, right? Or to provide a medical intervention to me. That's the narrowest sense of informed consent. But what I'm describing is having a meaningful conversation with your patient so that they can make a choice. Well, and that you can later describe that they made a choice.
Yes, that's really my point, is that we do not have meaningful conversations with our patients. And since those conversations are not required, I think it's a big black hole in the middle of our system.
I couldn't agree with you more, Doc. It's so funny. You know, one of my kids had to have emergency surgery on his hand because he cut an artery in one of his fingers. And everything turned out fine. But when I read his chart after the fact, you know, the hand surgeon said, oh, I clearly and in detail explained the risks, benefits, and downsides of the procedure and got informed consent. And no one spoke to his mother and I. Literally no one spoke to us. It had not occurred.
So I guess a good question is always to ask, are there any questions to the patient?
Yeah.
Thanks.
Hi, this is Dr. Cruz. I have an anecdote area where, as a OBGYN, I've had two lawsuits brought against me. One was for an ectopic pregnancy, and another was for bladder fistula. And with the first ectopic pregnancy, I, as the resident, had done informed consent, and I went over infection, bleeding, injury to surrounding organs, and then I also include death, because that basically covers it all. And the patient didn't have a problem after the procedure, but the husband had a problem after it. And he came back like 5 years later and brought a suit alleging that we had decreased her fertility, affecting his ability to increase their family, because she ended up losing her ovary, and then she had endometriosis, just a whole bunch of stuff. But, you know, the very fact that it even progressed to the point where because I was a resident at the time, and I was in Michigan, they had to come all the way to West Virginia, give me a deposition, and it went through the whole process, which was, you know, just a stressful thing that it's kind of, you know, you get tired that even if you give informed consent, you can still have the possibility of a suit brought against you. And then, you know, just even trying to defend yourself and, you know, having the deposition, getting a lawyer to defend you, that's money that you're just like, why am I doing this? This is a waste of time. So you just kind of get tired of doing stuff like that. And, you know, then you document, as you know, at OBGYN in Michigan, you learn how to document everything to the T, because that was one of the biggest states that had high malpractice suits and high rewards for patients who did win against physicians. So that was one thing. So even if you give informed consent, it's not really protective against you. And Marie mentioned earlier about standard of care. And one of the things that we have been discussing is, as alternative medicine, medical therapy physician, you know, practitioners, is to create a group where we create our standard of care. Because as you mentioned, Judge Egan, that you know, you can speak to the patient that what if you go to another endocrinologist and they're not going to, they won't treat you for the labs that we're looking at. But with our experience as, you know, as alternative medical practitioners, you will be benefiting from supplemental Armour thyroid and whatnot. So, you know, that's the big thing, is you can talk to your patients, but then some patients will just get a hair up their butt and see what they can do to punish you. I hate to say that, but informed consent, I it is important to get it, but sometimes it's not protective. You know, it's always just dot your T's and cross your T's and dot your I's. And, you know, I think creating a standard is where, you know, for alternative medical practitioners is where that protection is coming from. And then the other thing you had talked about with patients is, you know, if you do something wrong, is acknowledge it to the patient, and saying sorry is a big thing that I think that they have seen to actually decrease the amount of lawsuits or malpractice suits coming against physicians.
Yeah, Dr. Cruz, thank you for stepping into the fray, especially as an OBGYN. It is a high risk area, I'm sure. And to your point, it is excoriating and painful to be sued. I can only imagine, especially with claims of professional negligence. And to be sure, no matter how careful you are, you know, no good deed may go unpunished. But the one thing you said that I really want to emphasize, that I would emphasize to this group, is you can help each other. If, for example, you had a core group of quote unquote expertise or experts within the field of, call it integrative medicine or alternative integrative medicine, who are available to one another as peer experts, you could help in lawsuits if that was your desire for purposes of establishing or supporting an appropriate standard of care. That's unequivocally a good idea. So the American Medical Association has, you know, sub-practice areas that do that in cardiology and, you know, neurosurgery, probably in OBGYN as well.
So, yeah, I think Dr. Cruz, you can elaborate more than I think. Isn't Dr. Halassa's group working on something like that?
Yeah, that's what we were talking about. Just because, I mean, you know, you get someone who practices conventional medicine and they're going to say, you know, Dr. Clearfield, why are you giving this patient extra, you know, thyroid medication when there is no indication? And that's not, according to that family practice magazine that you just got, it's not following standard of care. So, you know, I this is where we were talking that if we form a group, that we understand that there are going to be practitioners who do, you know, like who use bioidentical hormones, use armored thyroid, and all the practices that we as alternative medical therapy practitioners use. And then there's always going to be the people who are, we have that bell-shaped curve of people who do regular alternative medical therapies. And then we have practitioners who do this stuff outside, which is where, you know, we have like the light therapies, methylene blue. I don't think that's like in the mainstream of alternative medical therapies at this point in time, or some of the oncology treatments. But, you know, it's on the edges that's where we find, you know, new innovative ways of treating our patients and having them, you know, get some benefits from those alternative therapies. So just creating some kind of group that we have created our standards. So like what Judge Egan has said is if we have those experts who are saying, who come in and say, yes, he's following, she is following what any alternative medical practitioner would do, then someone outside the group who is not versed in alternative therapies, like the doctor who says that you are
a shaman. I thought that was a good thing, but if you look up in the dictionary somewhere, about the eighth or ninth definition, it says as a dweller of the dark arts. I kind of like that, actually.
So you know, if he as a uninformed practitioner is not aware of the practices of the dwellers of the dark arts, then he cannot judge you to be not following a standard of care because he's just uneducated or uninformed regarding these therapies. You know, and I've been using the example of a cardiologist coming to an orthopod and saying, you, Dr. Orthopod, you are not following the standard of care. And the orthopod is going to say, you are a cardiologist. Who are you to judge me in my practice when you have no idea about my specialty? And so we can, you know, we can relate that to alternative medical practitioners and anyone else who, you know, anyone who comes out from left field saying, you guys, you know, you shaman don't know what you're doing and you're not following standard of care. We can say, we are following standard of care. You just don't know our standard because you are uneducated as far as, you know, as far as our practices are concerned. And that's where the protection is going to come from.
I don't know if that would that fly, Judge, our standard of care? That's, you know.
Well, fly is a difficult term to respond to, Dr. Clearfield. But what I would say is this, you can unequivocally help yourselves by having an evidence-based, you know, to overuse that overused term, but an evidence-based college of opinion in alternative medicine about standards of care with different therapies. Because then you have a rebuttal to the allopathic, you know, the more mainstream version of, to use the, you know, thyroid treatment example of internal med guys who say, well, if your thyroid isn't above your TSH isn't above a certain level, you shouldn't be getting meds. And you then have a rebuttal to it because in a medical malpractice trial, it becomes a battle of the experts, your expert versus their expert. And you want to have people with expert and expertise in the area of practice. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. So, what I've been doing for a long time now, because, you know, we ran into this thing, I've been doing this for a long time, is I keep what I call my reference project. And so on my, for example, did we give you the Magicare, plant sterolins?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So for those of you who don't know, the plant sterolins actually act almost like Pac-Man, and they will surround antibodies and actually almost like a phagocytosis, you know, sort of destroy them. They don't work that quickly, but they do work. They usually work. We, on average, will decrease the thyroid peroxidase antibody by about 50% in a year. So if somebody comes in with a TPO of 800, it's going to take a while to control it, but they do work. So I have plant sterolins. I keep a register, and I update it every once in a while. It gets to be kind of boring after a while. But so if somebody comes in and says, what are we giving Judge Walker plant sterolins for? I can hit a button and I have 51 references just on that. And I said, okay, here's 51 references. Is that enough? You know, I ran into a little problem with testosterone for women. The same endocrinologist said there was no indication for androgens in women for any reason. So I gave him a database. I sent him a database of 873 references, and this was 4 years ago. So we've actually added to that. So I've been doing that on my own, just you know, for because it kind of gets my blood boiling. You know, lately I do have patients that you know turn in their some of their prescriptions to be processed, and you know the insurance companies will send incredibly insulting letters, as you know, when they say we're not paying for this and we don't even know why anybody would prescribe this and we're not even going to give you a reason why we're not going to pay for this. And one of them was actually a 52-year-old woman who's, you know, had all the symptoms of low testosterone. Her testosterone level was 4. Her free testosterone was basically 0. I mean, you know, it was so again, I have a database, and I sent them. I have a letter already prepared, and it's got 37 different references, and all I have to do is put her name on it and whatever her client number, and off it goes. And I either don't hear anything and it gets approved, or I do get a letter back that it's approved. But so I've been doing that for a long time on my own, just because, you know, I have a thin skin, I guess. I don't know.
Well, and that's one of your goals of this organization, isn't it, Bill? I mean, one of the goals in the end is to establish a database, a library, a codex, a place.
Yeah. So we, you know, this group's actually been around. Dr. Spear can tell us better than me, since 1972, I believe. It fell into some disuse a number of years ago, and we sort of been building it back. So we're still kind of finding our way. I mean, technically we're supposed to be rheumatic diseases, but we've sort of taken in the integrative medicine group, and half the folks that you're seeing here are not DOs. We've got Dr. Kelly's a chiropractor, Dr. Zarin is a homeopath, and some of the other folks, I'm not even sure. I know Dr. Smith is an MD, the two folks up in the upper left-hand corner are my patients. They're just good old folks. We have quite a diverse, Dr. Crowley is a pharmacist. So we have quite a diverse group. Marie over here is our biggest cheerleader. She came all the way out from West Virginia to Las Vegas to our conference. She's just a layperson. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but that came out wrong. That would be an ideal. Personally, I don't have the time or the expertise to do that. If there's somebody here who would like to spearhead that would be great. We can get some structure and some guidelines, and I'm not even sure exactly what that would look like. What makes it a standard of care? I could write out, my protocol and say, okay, here's the standard of care from the American Osteopathic Society of Rheumatic Diseases for hypothyroidism. Just because I write it, does that make it so?
Well, it does over time, and it does when it becomes more accepted as a practice standard, meaning by standard, I mean more replicated, and especially as you publish about it in peer-reviewed literature. And there's always going to be a fight. My favorite story about allopathic physicians happened last summer. I had a terrible mesothelioma case where an electrician is dying of this terrible, terrible disease. And a very well-credentialed, very quote-unquote well-respected cardiologist came into court and wanted to testify that he could opine as to the hour and date of this man's death. And I threw him out of court. I said, there's no science behind that, doc. Just because you say you're a cardiologist doesn't mean you can or anybody could opine as to the hour and date of any individual's death. There's no science behind that. So to answer your question, Dr. Clearfield, I love the idea that you're building a library, I call it a codex, of the science which formulates the basis for your medical decision-making with your patients. And that is, over time, a standard of care. Doesn't mean everybody will agree with you about it, but at least it gives you something to point to.
Right. Okay. So, for instance, one of my favorite lectures that I give is testosterone in women. And at the end of I actually photocopied it, and it's on our slide, right from the doctors. I didn't retype it. I said, this is the real thing. And I said, okay, here's 105 peer-reviewed references from such disreputable journals as the New England Journal of Medicine, Journal of American Medical Association, Journal of OBGYN, on and on down the line. And at the end of the lecture, I said, I don't think 105 was enough. Here's another 175 more. So, and it goes on for, 20, 30 slides. And nobody ever looks at them, but that's sort of something that I just kind of did as a reflex. I don't know if anybody else here, has sort of put together anything like that, but we could certainly start to use that as at least a jumping off point. Because I do it for what I do. I kind of keep my focus, fairly narrowed. Dr. Spear is a little bit more of a traditional rheumatologist. Dr. Richwine does mostly osteopathic medicine. Dr. Patel, you have something you want to add? You're muted. We can't hear you.
I said, you have covered majority of it. So, you know, I wonder the word alternative medicine versus complementary medicine. And because what we are really practicing is not alternative. We are just practicing better medicine. So we are complementing. And so we are not doing the traditional conventional medicine. But I mean, you know, they prescribe thyroid, we prescribe thyroid. So we are not doing anything alternative. We are just complementing what is not being done right. And we are just correcting it.
All right, so
this is one of my opinions, that when we say we are alternative care practitioner, we are creating a problem for ourselves. But if you say we are integrative or we are environmental or we are functional, in again, we are restricting. We are complementary medicine physician. We are practicing. Our practice approach is wider. We look at the various other factors, and so we are providing patient better care.
But an interesting question just popped up, Dr. Clearfield, in the chat.
Right.
Do you want to?
Yeah, I was going to read it to you, but go ahead.
So the question is off-label prescription of medication safe use? And the short answer is yes, if you can show your homework. Right, to this point about standard of care, when you discussed with me using naltrexone, and you pointed out it was an off-label use, you pointed out, which I believe to be true, that there are several peer-reviewed studies that you can point to that show there's a powerful anti-inflammatory effect from that off-label use. And so off-label use in and of itself is not a deviation from the standard of care. If there is an evidence-based kind of basis for the use that you can point to. It is unusual. I mean, it does open you up to the question about it. And, you know, we haven't even touched upon, this is now a patient perspective. So much of what happens in medicine is driven by money and not by what is best for us as patients, in my opinion. And so the whole off-label use is as much about whether or not pharmaceutical companies getting their share as anything else. That's just my opinion. Have I answered the question?
Right. I think so. So let me bring this to you. So let's talk about ivermectin for COVID. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I prescribed it. We've had very good success with it. You know, just this week. A paper came out that it was ineffective for preventing hospitalizations or severe COVID infections. It was in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it was on a lot of the bulletins, and I'm sure a lot of you folks might have seen it also. But if you looked at what they did, so our protocol was 5 days at a specific dose per weight. 5 days for, you know, with an acute COVID infection with several other entities. I mean, it was a whole protocol. The paper that came out said that they used, lower doses than we've used. And I'm looking at the frontline doctors, you know, the ones that are, sort of at the forefront of this, lower doses than we've used. And they used it for 3 days. But the headline was, it didn't work. So where do you go with that?
Well, the legal answer is this. If you can't show the homework or the basis for a treatment that you're prescribing, you're always going to be open to the possibility that somebody, you don't speak much about it, Dr. Clearfield, but I suspect you take a lot of heat from your peers in the allopathic community here in Washoe County. this medical community is very well compensated, very powerful politically, and they don't let outsiders in very easily. That's just my opinion as a patient. And so if they found out, you know, or somebody got a wild hair and said, well, Clearfield's using ivermectin, let's run him out of town on a rail, and tried to cook up a lawsuit. I don't know how they would do that. You know, a patient would have to have a bad outcome, but nonetheless, try to cook up a lawsuit. Your defense is going to be pointing to the science. You know, here's my homework. Here's the why I have prescribed it, and here's the scientific basis for it. If you can't do that, I wouldn't prescribe it.
Well, I'm getting too old for that anyway. So if I can't do that, then I won't.
Yeah.
But like I said, so we're going to talk about plant sterilants. You know, the MagiCare is not the only one. There's a few of them, but I've never heard anybody, you know, outside of our group, you know, the people that we've studied with, you know, even know what it is. Yeah. And, you know, it's the one thing that I found, and I've been doing complementary medicine for 25 years now. It's the one thing that I found that will consistently, control the thyroid antibodies. And if you don't control the thyroid antibodies, you know, within 5 years of them, you know, sort of sprouting up, you're going to have a destroyed thyroid. I mean, and, you know, and then there's a point of no return at that point. So anyway, so another question is, can you use animal studies as evidence to support human treatment for humans? I think that's done, isn't it?
It is. You know, the way the science of medicine plays out in the courtroom, you have to understand is this. A jury, strangely, is the one deciding whether or not you have deviated from the standard of care. And the way the jury does it is by listening to experts, competing experts. So the plaintiff's expert or the defense expert. And all of those experts are going to rely on whatever studies they think support their position, right? And of course, animal studies are a part of the basic science behind many medical interventions that happen to humans. So in the shortest sense, yes, you can draw analogy to animal studies, but it really comes down to how persuasive the science is that you're relying upon and how persuasive the expert is who's going to support your position about that use. Because you're, in the end, lay people, the jurors are deciding if a mistake was made, as strange as that sounds. And so a part of the challenge of medical malpractice litigation is simplifying it, condensing very complex biochemical issues, physiological issues into an understandable form. And that's as much about the expert involved as it is about the science, you know, the persuasiveness of the expert.
Okay. The only thing I just put on there, this is where all of our transcripts and our videos go, aosrd.org/webinars. If you're, you know, you missed part of this, or any of our other, lectures from, we've been doing this for more than a year and a half now. So we have quite a body of literature here, stored up, on there. With that, so one of my favorite stories, maybe you can comment on this, so that everybody here, or at least all the doctors know, when you were a nurse, so you probably know, H. pylori is a cause of peptic ulcers, right? Right? No argument about it. No question about it. Well, in 1983, it was a Dr. Marshall, he was an Australian gastroenterologist, first presented H. pylori as a bacterial infection as a cause for, chronic gastritis and peptic ulcers. He was laughed out of the arena. He had his medical license taken away. He went so far as to make a slurry of H. pylori and drink it himself, and then have himself endoscoped to prove that that the H. pylori caused the peptic ulceration. And ultimately, 25 years later, he was actually awarded a Nobel Prize. So those kind of stories are, kind of heartwarming, but when you're in the middle of it, it's not a whole lot of fun. Any suggestions for, when you find yourself in those kinds of crosshairs?
Well, the only thing I would share with you is this, And I sort of wanted to open this up when Dr. Patel was talking. It's remarkable to me as a patient how narrow-minded we are in the United States about medical treatment. I mean, there are ancient cultural treatments. I mentioned, a treatment you offered to me when my knee was hurting. That is ancient in derivation and ancient in use. And there are all sorts of complementary, to use Dr. Patel's word, medical procedures and interventions from different cultures across the world that are just discarded outright by traditional medicine in the United States for reasons I can't really explain. And I guess the best reflection I would have for you is this, is to kind of put a nice bow on things. So I've had the privilege of going to an alternative or an integrative medicine doc or whoever else who really genuinely seems to care about his patients in the sense of their outcome. And last week, you don't even know this, doc, last week, 18 months after I've had two total knee replacements, and when I came to you 4 years ago, almost diabetic, or 2 weeks ago, I pulled 5 pounds over the national record in deadlift. And so what I'm trying to dive to is just do what works for your patients as well. And you've got to have some homework behind it, some basis for it, but you also do treat, right? The human being and what works for them. Right.
Right. So the other thing is I like to think that after all this time, like my mother used to say, I should know what I'm doing by now. So, sometimes experience, is a great teacher also.
And you have to have some bravery about it. I'm sure I can't, I don't know. I don't know the risks you all take. I can't know them because I don't have the expertise you have, but you have to have some bravery about it to be sure.
Can I ask something?
Sure. Go ahead.
So I'm very new to all this, but one of the things that kind of scratched the surface a long time ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I had a family that was telling me about Dr. Bradstreet. And apparently he was treating autistic patients and doing some complementary treatments. And then he was found dead. They said, it was self-inflicted, but it wasn't. And then, I think I'm more concerned about those kind of consequences. I mean, I guess right before that, he had had his, his practice raided after a judge had signed a warrant for some stuff to be pulled there. Do you know anything about, I guess people are asking me now that I'm kind of delving into craziness is what I would call it. I feel like I'm pulling back the sheet on the matrix, maybe. Like, that's what I feel like every day now. But I don't tell people that I'm doing that. Like, people, when they come in, I say, if I see something that I've learned that might help them, I want to offer it to them, but I'm very under the radar. I don't want to end up like that. I guess, do you know anything about what had happened with that person, or?
Not anything I'm familiar with, but Judge, you mentioned about the year that I moved here, the urologist got shot or something.
Well, so I don't know if that is connected to the issue that Ms. Kylie is talking about or not, but I will tell you as a judge, I've practiced law. I was a prosecutor. I was in private practice, and I've now been a judge for 14 years. And so 32 years of experience in Northern Nevada. I don't know that a doctor's office has ever been searched on a search warrant by a judge. That doesn't mean that it couldn't happen. I'm just saying that's a very rare occurrence is the first reassurance I would give you. The second is, physician, heal thyself. You have to know what your risk tolerance is and what you're willing to ride in terms of heat. However edgy your practice may be. But to your point, Dr. Clearfield, the year you moved here, there was a terrible case where a gentleman had a prostatectomy, a fairly standard procedure with fairly well-known consequences. And because he was unhappy with the results, came in and killed one of the physicians in the practice and mortally wounded another. The poor lady surgeon, was a surgeon and right-handed, and he blew her right arm off with a shotgun. And so it was a terrible, terrible, awful case, related to, a patient's subjective perspective about a bad outcome. And it's just flat wrong for a patient to project their bad outcome onto a physician, which is, I think, what the OBGYN was talking about before. I mean, one of the risky things you all do is, projection is a natural human tendency. Anytime something goes wrong in somebody's life, it's inevitably got to be someone else's fault, right? The same is true in my business.
I have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm Dr. Nario. So we're alternative practitioners. So let's say, FDA or anybody who's going to come into our clinic would try to inspect what we do. Who should we recognize as authorities? And what should we do for this? Like, should we look for a warrant first before they go in? Or should we call our lawyer first before they get into our clinics? What are your suggestions for these situations?
So I have to be careful not to give you legal advice, but I'll give you practical advice. Yes, you should call your lawyer. You should recognize the licensure of anyone. So you have a business license, right? So if the city, pursuant to the business license, wants to come in, you have to make your business available to them. If you have a medical or a professional license, somebody associated with the licensing agency, you have to be responsive to. But yeah, I would unequivocally, if somebody's coming in to inspect your practice, to kind of go over things with a fine tooth comb and you're concerned about it, I would unequivocally get a hold of my lawyer.
Meaning they shouldn't come in and ask for documents first, or well, hold on, I'll call my lawyer before you get into the facility.
Yeah, I would try to message to anybody, look, I'm going to be cooperative, but I'm sure you can understand I need to refer to legal counsel before I actually respond to any of your requests.
Also, definitely not let them in and inspect until you call your channel. Well,
doctor, the question implicates such a broad range. So the cops could show up at your facility, right? Say, I have a search warrant. And if you tell them you're not coming in, they're going to break down the door. I'm not sure I would stand in their way under that circumstance. But if somebody whose legitimacy you question, or whose authentication you question, they show you a badge, or they don't show you a badge. They claim to be, I'm a so-and-so inspector from so-and-so organization. I would probably tell them, look, I want to be cooperative and I want to be transparent, but I hope you can appreciate I need to talk to my lawyer before I actually reveal anything to you.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else? Questions? So it was a little bit before my time, but Dr. Forsythe is one of our colleagues here in our group, and he speaks to us quite often. And I don't know if you were around when he had his trouble with growth hormone and the feds. Do you remember anything about that at all?
None of it rings a bell with me now.
It was around 2005. I guess he was getting it from Israel, and they came at 6 o'clock in the morning. I mean, he's 82 now, so it was about 15 years ago. So he was in his 60s then, and guns drawn to his house at 6 a.m.
Good gracious.
So I don't know anybody else on here from town. This was before my time here, so if he remembers any of that. I mean, if you type in HGH and legal, and the law in Reno, I mean, it comes right up in the newspaper article anyway, so.
Okay, I work with Dr. Forsythe, so he does tell me these stories.
Yeah, he talks about it all the time. Yeah, so
it is real.
I know. He talks about it all the time. So, but
it even came to me that I think they went to his house to investigate something. But I guess the star of that show really is the clinic that he was working in.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So he turned it around on them, and he ended up writing the guidelines for HGH, to the legitimate uses of HGH. I think that's what came out of that. But you know, I'm at the point in my life where I don't really want to deal with anything like that, you know.
Understandably.
Do my thing and go home at the end of the day. I don't really want to deal with any of this other nonsense.
Yeah, understandably.
So, okay. Anybody else have any questions or comments or, So believe it or not, you know, OMED, which is the AOA Scientific Convention, is coming up at the end of October, and Dr. Burgess and I are going to have to start getting that together, even though we just finished with our Las Vegas deal a couple of weeks ago. I still don't have the videos if you're looking for them, so I'm pressing them. And we will put them up on the website with password protected, so you'll have them when they're available. I think Dr. Zarin wants to speak a little bit about, you know, what we're going to be doing in the next week. Judge Walker, I can't thank you enough. It's been very interesting, and we had a lot of good information. I'm getting a lot of attaboys in the chat here. You know, we really appreciate you taking your time and you know, explaining things from you know, from your perspective, you know, from your legal perspective. And I'm sorry I didn't have the video on when you were patting me on the back, but it was getting to be kind of embarrassing, and I may have trouble getting my head out the door anyway. So we'll leave that alone. So
it's been a great privilege. Thank you all for having me.
Thank you so much, and we'll see you soon. Okay.
Take good care, everybody.
Okay. So before you go though, so Dr. Zarin, you want to just say a couple words?
Hi. Hello, everyone. So, Dr. Fielfield, you didn't talk about it in the beginning?
I didn't. I was waiting for you.
You did. Yes, I just want to thank Sir Walker. That was the most useful meeting I've ever attended. So that, even though I'm in Canada, but I have so many questions that I got answers. So it's similar. But I hope that it could be a little bit longer that I could have some of my questions. So in regards to the next week, so I think some of you guys have already know, and Dr. Clifford already announced it, that we created a course for the aftermath of hysterectomy. So this course actually is by Dr. Clifford and by myself, even though it's coming from two different perspectives and views, but it's very compatible and complementing each other modalities. For example, I'm a homeopath, and in a homeopathic domain, for example, we do not give hormone replacement therapy after, such as hysterectomy. So personally, I work on different pathways in order to stimulate the endocrine system and the organs in order to make enough female hormones, progesterone, estrogen, for the state of that particular person after the surgery. So it would be interesting if you listen to our talk and see how compatible the talk would be. By doing this, I know that Dr. Clifford has a different domain, but as I heard his talk through our conferences, we are very compatible. And by doing this, it's helping the person after hysterectomy to heal much faster and actually healthier. So I hope that all of you can attend next week to listen to us and see how it goes.
Okay. All right.
Anybody
else? Any questions, comments, complaints? Dr. Smith, are you okay over there?
Dr. Clearfield, Dr. Patel. So I want to know your overview on what I said about complementary medicine.
Dr. Patel, talking to me?
No, yes. Dr. Bell, you can answer that.
Oh. Well, you know, I've always been of the mind that I'm not doing alternative or integrative or complementary medicine. I'm doing medicine. This is medicine. I'm not, you know. The books I read are available to anybody. I mean, I'm not hoarding anything, you know, just because, You know, Dr. So-and-so in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania hasn't opened a textbook since 1970, that was written in 1978, you know, and that's the standard of care. I mean, that's their issue. I just think of it as medicine. I don't think of it as a complementary or alternative. And that's kind of my starting point. Like I said, though, I've been keeping this, reference project, and I get to it every when I get a spur. So in the last 2 weeks, I've gotten two insulting letters from insurance companies about, you know, they don't even need to, you know, respond to, we gave the two women with menopausal women with low testosterone levels and symptomatic low testosterone levels. And there's no need for that. So our expert says that there's no need for that. I said, well, your expert is wrong. Your expert's no expert. I tell them right out. They don't like it. They don't like it, but I always get it overturned, you know, with a small victory. I mean, but that's my perspective is that what we're doing, we're doing is medicine. It's not alternative medicine. We're osteopaths. They try to make it a distinction. It's osteopathic medicine, which is, and then they kind of, you know, unless you're doing manipulation like Dr. Irwin and whatnot, it kind of loses something in the translation, I think. You'll find more, I think, those of us that have the sort of the same philosophy in the DO world and the MDs, but, like Dr. Smith over here, we're breaking them down slowly. So don't be scared. We got your back. Don't worry about it. Okay. We have your back.
Thank you.
You run into a problem, you know where to find us. Okay. You know where to find me and Dr. Burgess down at the left down here. He's a font of information also. Okay.
Yeah. I'm also a font of website names. So, as far as Dr. Patel's concerned about what this is called, and I, like Bill and 1,000 others, have gone through holistic, complementary, alternative, integrative, all that stuff. But I did get a web name in case we ever need it, because it's also definitive of what we do. And it's good.healthcare. www.good.healthcare. Because that's all we're talking about. There are ways I think we can prove it's good.healthcare, and I didn't bring it up here because I didn't want to get into a debate about it. But if you're going to establish protocols, you also have to establish principles. I think we have those principles, but we haven't spoken about it. And when Judge Walker said we can't make them agree upon it, I think we can make them agree upon it. And once we get them to agree to our game, we will set the rules. We will set the standards. But, all these, you know, things like this are important. What is it? We're not stuck on the side. We're just practicing good health care. Another alternative would be ethical health care. But we own good.health care should we need it. And we also have osteopathicinstitute.com if we want to establish other protocols in osteopathy and document it and research it. We can do that.
And a little bit on the lighter side, I also own one called HoochieMama.org.
That's it. That's a good one.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think I saw it on a Seinfeld episode. I think Kramer was yelling with some sort of code word, HoochieMama, and I remember saying, that would be a great web domain name. And I looked it up, and .com was taken, but .org was not. So guess who? I've never used it, but but we have it.
At the risk of offending everyone, I will say I also have massageballs.com.
Oh.
It depends upon how you take it, right?
Yeah, right.
So there's some things you can say and some things you can't, but good health care is something we can do.
Okay. Okay. So next week, Dr. Zarin and I will be presenting progesterone after hysterectomy from my perspective and from hers. Okay. And any questions, comments? So you hand paws out there. You got anything to say?
Thank you, Bill.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Patel and Dr. Ortel. Dr. Kelly, thank you for being with us. And Dr. Cruz, thank you for participating. Dr. Sabani, thank you for being with us. Dr. Ching, as always. Dwight, and then our usual Dr. Renza, Marie, thank you all. I'm going to sign off. We'll have this up as soon as I can get it up, usually within 24 to 48 hours. Next week we'll be doing, like Dr. Patel, Dr. Azarin and I, let you know. And if you're interested in presenting at OMED, please get in touch with either Dr. Burgess or myself. And, when is that? October 27th to 29th in Boston? I think that's when
around there in the 20s.
Yeah. I think that's when it is. It's in Boston. I'm sure it'll be, virtual also. Hopefully they don't chicken out like they did last year at the last minute. So anyway, good night, everybody. Thank you so much. We'll be in touch. David, thank you so much for being here again. And whoever phone number is at the bottom right there, I don't know who it is. All I have is a phone number. So thank you all so much, and we'll see you again next week, same time, same station.
Good night, everyone.
Yep.